And so let's join David Fisher, who is, as I speak, gently stroking a colleague's body, as we do every day at this time at ABC Radio National.
Geraldine, thank you for coming into the Science Show laboratory.
Thank you, I think, David.
And what I'd like to do is, if I could just take your forearm.
Yes.
Thank you. So I'll hold your wrist and the forearm is right. Placed upwards. Mm. And I'm going to stroke your arm. Mm. And I'd like you to describe the response.
Very pleasant.
Very pleasant.
Yes.
I'm now going to do it faster. How does it compare?
Not as pleasant.
Now I'm going to do it much slower. How does it compare?
Not as pleasant.
Medium again?
Yeah, that's ideal.
That's ideal?
Soothing.
Right. And now I'm going to do it at the same speed, but harder.
No, that's not nearly as pleasant. It's not bad. It's just pressure. It doesn't induce a pleasant feel.
So what combination of speed and force do you think evokes for you the most satisfying, the most pleasurable response?
Well, it was definitely that moderate response from you. It's funny, now that I think about it. It's the visual impact of just your nice, gently moving, even hand, so that's a contact point. So I'm observing that, and I'm feeling just a very nice tranquility almost, I suppose. Yes, very soothing.
Well, okay, let's leave them in private. It's important to get it right. Stroke gently and lightly and at the correct speed. Fortunately, we now have both a scientific study and a stroking robot to ensure it's done properly. Dr. Francis McGlone is the lead neuroscientist with Unilever UK.
We needed to develop a stroking machine that had complete control over velocity and, importantly, force. And that's not an easy thing to do.
So in other words, you had to be stroked in a particular way that you could then measure. You can't say to Fred, go up and stroke Frida, because you never quite tell how much stroking's going on.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, our first observations were just using a camel hair brush and stroking that and seeing that these nerve fibres got more activated and that people responded saying, yes, that's pleasant. But to quantify the system precisely, we need to do it robotically or mechanically. And what our rotary tactile stimulator allows us to do now is to look at the precise relationship between subtle changes in velocity and force. And what we find is that these tactile pleasure systems are very finely tuned. They will respond optimally to a stroking velocity of about 5 centimetres per second. They'll respond less if you move faster than that, and less if you move slower than that. So they're tuned to activate at particular velocities, and they are also very force sensitive. So if we stroke them at around about a gram or at a higher force, that changes people's response to how pleasant or unpleasant that stimulus has been. So they're force sensitive and they're velocity sensitive. So that the robotic tactile stimulator allows us to measure these responses precisely with statistical power. And also importantly, we can use this system with brain imaging devices where we can stroke people and use imaging to look inside the brain to see which areas are activated and how the activation changes when we stroke faster or stroke slower.
So you can actually show that it's kind of medium range, not too slow, not too fast, yep. Not too heavy, and that kind of works. Now, what about the fact that it's a machine doing it? Because I know Sarah Blakemore at University College London did a tickling survey which showed that you can't tickle yourself. And obviously it takes someone else unexpectedly to touch you in a way that you can't control to get the response. Is there a kind of authentic response from a machine that way?
No, and we're well aware that we're looking at a part of the system here. So we're working with the rotary tactile stimulator at the bottom-up input into the system. But we are not unaware of the fact that there's a powerful social context to touch, which is modulated by what we call top-down processes.
So you get actually more fun from a direct person. But what actually gives you the pleasure? What sort of chemicals turn you on as a result of that touching?
Research that was done looking at monkey colonies that were grooming, these are terrapin monkeys that were used, is that when these monkeys were given naltrexone, which is an opiate blocker. It increased the number of grooming bouts that these monkeys were engaged in. If another group of monkeys was given low, non-sedative doses of opiates, then their grooming bouts decreased. So the conclusion from that study is that grooming behaviour itself releases endogenous opiates, i.e. the endorphins and enkephalins that most people have heard about. And that's part of the brain's own mood and well-being centre. And our interest is to find evidence that grooming behaviours are rewarding and they're good for you. We think there's a link with serotonin as well, and serotonin is a neurotransmitter that powerfully regulates mood, and it's the neurotransmitter that many antidepressants affect in terms of the reuptake inhibitors that keep the serotonin levels high. Is that we would also hypothesise that serotonin is also involved in modulating these responses to touch, as it is to other stimuli as well.
So as people who are drug addicts are taking these various drugs to turn themselves on, implying that there might be some sort of lacking, it would, to turn the argument round, if you're not being sufficiently hugged when you're little, you would have a kind of deficit that would be a problem. Would that follow, or is that too great a leap?
We've known for many years that preterm infants, if they're not handled every day, stroked and cuddled, their immune systems don't develop effectively and their birth weight doesn't increase significantly. And the only mediation there that increases that infant's health is touch. We know from other research that touch is a very important experience, sensory experience for a developing brain. And we can extrapolate again into cuddling and hugging and stroking babies, which most, you know, healthy, normal mothers will do, is evolutionarily beneficial to the overall development of that brain and ultimately that person's social well-being. And your question is a leading question, but I think you're absolutely right, is that if people have a poor tactile history, they may have a higher incidence of depression. So I'm working with a psychiatrist in Manchester who's interested in looking at that relationship. And you can see that grooming behaviours, if promoted, could be very beneficial to global health. And that's not a great extreme in the fact that grooming is good for you. It's not just about cleaning. It's about feeling good. So understanding the system gives up the confidence to pursue ways to promote it.
Yes, you're saying actually that it affects the structure of the brain. Dramatic as that.
The way that the brain develops in early term infancy is dependent upon the experiences that brain gets. So if the brain is deprived of visual input, auditory input, tactile input, at critical stages in development, it will never wire up effectively. So that's the extreme example. Based on that, yes, the brain that you have now was dependent upon the experiences you first got as a developing infant and probably way back in the womb. So what you see, what you hear, what you feel, what you touch, what you smell affects that developing brain and the way it makes you who you are. So yes, I think we can confidently say that if you're deprived of touch in the very early stages of development, there could well be a consequence that manifested itself in some social or cognitive problem later on in life. But we don't have the evidence.
Yeah. What's going on with autistic kids then who don't like to be touched?
Well, again, that was of interest to me, and it's research that I know is being done in places like America, where one of the hallmarks of autism is that kids don't like being touched, but we don't know why.
Well, let me ask you a question about you talk about the extent of the stroke or the heaviness thereof, which can turn it into something different. What about the spectrum between the tickle, the stroke, and on the other hand, the itch, getting to the pain end of things? I mean, can you understand why scratching an itch is so important to us?
It has often fascinated me, and one of the other research areas that I've looked at is itch, because there are some chemicals that some people find irritant, and the reason they're irritant is because they activate nerve fibres that tell the brain that there's itch or sting there. I've particularly looked at itch because scalp itch is a big problem with dandruff, etc. And it happens that a group in Germany in 2002 have found another C fibre, this time a C fibre that specifically encodes for itch. So we now know there's an itch channel in the same way there's a pain channel, and also we think a pleasure channel, all mediated by C fibres. So one C fibre system seems to code for pleasure and one codes for itch. There could be a relationship between scratching and itch, to relieve that sensation. The reason it feels pleasant may be because these pleasure fibres are playing a part in the reward, the pleasant feeling that you get for it. But it is a conundrum, and it fascinates me why scratching an itch should be so powerfully rewarding.
I wonder whether you remember that amazing picture. I saw it in one of the journals about 6 months ago, of the woman who'd scratched her head so hard it actually went through to the brain. What the earth was going on there?
That was a pathological condition. It's potentially unique, but I think it shows how powerfully motivating an itch is in terms of alleviating the suffering. I mean, most of us take itch very lightly. You know, we just have a scratch and everything's okay. But there are large populations of patients who have chronic skin conditions which are causing chronic itch. And you've just got to imagine what it's like to never be able to relieve an itch. Yeah? And what these patients do is to scratch that skin area until it bleeds quite often. So people with psoriasis and urticaria, the power of this stimulus is such that they will damage that skin and they will rip it until it's bleeding to get rid of the itch, because the pain is in fact more preferable to the itch. But the extreme conditions, such as the patient that you talked about, is showing how far that system can go to drive self-destruction in that woman scratching through her skin, through her skull, and then, you know, to the meninges or surfaces of her brain because she couldn't stop.
That terrible itch. Professor Francis McGlone at the University of Liverpool. Next week we go to India to hear how traditional agriculture manages to preserve biodiversity so that the birds still flourish on the farm. And we'll also go to Charles Darwin's Old College in Cambridge to see how they're preparing for next year. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Charlie McCune, with help from Jane Connors and the very strokeable Geraldine Doogue. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.